Previously on Robbery, Inc.
When we got the call, you know, several officers responded, and we looked the building over and could not find any entrance or anything that was out of order or out of the ordinary.
Merida police responded to false alarms at the Cobb Exchange Bank days prior to the Mission Impossible burglary, unaware of thieves toiling and tunneling under their feet. Early into their investigation, law enforcement discovered hundreds of pieces of evidence and collected thorough eyewitness testimony from locals with the help of the FBI.
They ate there. I mean, you know, they spent the night there. And of course, they was in no hurry.
Law enforcement were on the hunt for three men, two with the aliases of Harold Murphy and Leslie Ray, last seen with a blue Chevy Impala. But most shocking of all, our bandits were much more successful than the public ever realized. $22,000 had been taken from the vault, at least $9,000 in cash. That's close to $145,000 by today's standards. So much for a petty theft. In April 1974, a group of thieves tunneled beneath Roswell Street in Merida, Georgia, and blasted their way into the Cobb Exchange Bank vault, only to be mocked for escaping with just $1,000. But as investigators dug deeper, they uncovered a far bigger mystery and the story of a career bank robber whose daring heists and prison escapes made him a legend. This is Robbery, Inc., from Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Merida Daily Journal. On April 21st, 1974, just one day before bank robbers, okay, I'm going to pause here. Bank robbers, bank burglars, you know, technically they did burglarize the bank, but they would go on to be bank robbers. So let's just go with culprits. On April 21st, 1974, just one day before our culprits would breach the safety deposit vault by tunneling up into the Cobb Exchange Bank in Marietta, a small story appeared on the front page of the local Sunday paper. Its headline read, "Cobb Exchange Bank to Open Wednesdays," in the Merida Daily Journal. Business editor Ben Cook quoted Cobb Exchange Bank president Neil Barfield about the decision to be the first Merida-based bank to switch to the Monday through Friday banking week. The bank, which had operated for more than 120 years by 1974, would break its long-standing local tradition of opening on Saturdays. By May of that year, the Cobb Exchange would now open its doors to customers on Wednesdays. Ben Cook would write,
"Local bankers have speculated on the Cobb Exchange switch to Wednesday banking for more than a year. Ever since Barfield, the youngest bank president in Cobb, was named president of the Cobb Exchange Bank about a year ago. Cobb Exchange is Cobb's fourth largest bank with assets of approximately $40 million.
By Monday afternoon, the Cobb Exchange would grace the front page of the Merida Daily Journal again. Neil Barfield would be immortalized in a black and white picture, dressed in his suit and tie, hands placed on his knees. An inquisitive look frozen on his brow as he peered through thick glasses into the dirt tunnel that ran from the emergency aid building into the bank on Roswell Street. This time, the headline read, "Tunneling Burglars Hit Cobb Exchange Bank." I'm Madison Elizabeth Hogan. This is Robbery, Inc., Episode 3, Manhunt. In our last episode, we covered the incredible feat of how our assailants managed to tunnel through 135 feet of dirt in 20 inches of steel-reinforced concrete into the safe deposit box room at the Cobb Exchange Bank. We recounted how locals and news outlets nationwide regarded the crime as an ambitious Mission Impossible-style tale gone wrong with little money to show for it. we discovered leads and clues to the identities of our perps. And most importantly, we set the record straight on how much was actually stolen from the Cobb Exchange Bank. Not $1,000, but more than $22,000. But how did this number manage to get lost in the mix? For that, I went to talk to the Cobb Exchange president himself, Neil Barfield. Can you state your name for me?
This is Neil Barfield.
And how long have you lived in Marietta?
I've lived in Marietta all my life. I was born in 1940. I am a fifth generation native of Marietta.
His career in banking began in 1970 when he left First National Bank to work at Cobb Exchange Bank, eventually becoming its president in April 1973. As president, he was responsible for hiring staff, overseeing loans, and managing investments. At the time, the bank had about 30 to 40 employees and served 300 to 500 customers.
And you were the youngest bank president at the time.
Absolutely. Youngest bank president in the state of Georgia.
And you were the youngest bank president for about 10 years, is that correct?
About 10 years, from 73 to 83. And in 83, our bank, Cobb Exchange Bank, stockholders decided to sell. They sold out.
The 1970s were a period of rapid growth for Marietta and Cobb County.
We were basically a very growing community and county. Most of our business as bankers was lending money to developers and builders that would build subdivisions. And of course, we handled any merchants that were in business. We'd handle their banking business.
The bank expanded by acquiring other institutions, growing from $30 million to $100 million in assets. Despite its success, Cobb Exchange was always the second largest bank in town, with First National Bank of Marietta holding the top spot. Neil Barfield was at another branch the morning of April 22, 1974, when he received the call.
I was not at the bank that day. I was at our branch bank out on Power Spring Street, which I had been the manager of for over a year prior to being elected president of the bank. But I was not at Cobb Exchange Bank when that happened. I got a phone call from the bank, and they said, "Come over here immediately. People have broken into the vault." So I left. I went over there, and sure enough, walked in and found what was going on, that they had gone into our safe deposit box, went up under the bank building, came up in the middle of that vault, dynamite, and blew a hole in the floor and came up that way. But they was in the safe deposit box, and obviously they couldn't, there was anything. Only cash that was around in that vault was what the tellers had in their drawer that day, which would have been just $2,000 or $3,000 total, you see. Now, we had another money vault where we kept all our big money, was in another room. It was not visible from the main room there where the safe deposit box. Safe deposit box vault was next to our teller's line. So everybody came in and went up to talk to the teller to make a deposit or make a withdrawal. Looked over and saw the safe deposit box. They thought that was the vault because that was a big, big vault. It had a great big steel door on everything. You see, it had to be open. But it was the only thing in there was our safe deposit boxes. And the tellers would take their cash that they had in their drawer that day and put it on a little stroller and push it into that vault that night. So that was all it was in. The only money was in there was just the cash that they had at the end of the day in their drawer, teller drawer.
What were some of your initial thoughts after you get a phone call telling you to rush right over, somebody's burglarized the bank, You get to the scene, you see this giant gaping hole in your safety deposit box room. What are your initial thoughts?
So, oh my goodness, it just absolutely scared me to death. I can't believe it. This could go on. So, and I knew the fellow that owned the building across the street, you see, so I called him, talked to him about it, and I went over there.
Neil Barfield immediately contacted Arthur Crow, the owner of the building across the street, whom he knew well.
Oh, yeah, I knew Arthur Crow real well. And he's a great, great fellow, and a good lawyer in town. And he and, I knew Arthur.
Arthur Crow, a respected local lawyer and the owner of the building used in the heist, was shocked when he learned what had happened. He had only been leasing the space for 2 months and had no idea it was being used for a crime.
Well, let's put it this way. When people say, is Arthur Crow your father? I say it depends on who's asking.
Remember Peggy Crow from episode 1 and 2? She's the daughter of Arthur Crow, a prominent attorney in Marietta who also owned the building our bank burglars had rented out. Peggy worked with Neil Barfield as a bank teller in the Cobb Exchange in 1974.
So there was nobody who was ambivalent about him. He was he was the city attorney for a while. He was, he's hard to describe because he just would flaunt the rules. He was the worst dresser ever. I'd seen him, I worked down at the juvenile court downtown. And there were times that I would see him walking downtown and I would cross the street so I didn't have to say hello to him. He was a lawyer and he had a law practice where he had a female law partner in the early 60s. And she was from the backwoods of West Virginia. So her name was Nita Martin and people used to come to court just to listen to her because she was so funny.
What kind of businesses, aside from his law practice, was your father involved in?
You know, it's hard to say with Daddy. He did real estate things. He had bought some buildings around Cobb Parkway. And he bought land and did those kinds of things. So he was a real sportsman. So he spent a lot of time outside hunting and fishing. That was his life. And he was one of the first people to have an organic garden in the 60s. So he was always ahead of his time, but he was totally intense about whatever he did.
Now, Arthur's no longer with us, but can you recall maybe what his demeanor was like that day? I mean, he finds out that his building that he's been leasing to for 2 months was used for this crime. What was going on that day?
He just didn't, happen, but didn't have any reaction to that. He didn't know anything about it. He didn't know anything about it. Just knew when I told him what, come over and I'll show him what happened. And he did, walked in and saw what was going on. Then he invited me back over to his building and so I could go through that tunnel myself. And I did.
The tunnel, roughly 3x3 or 4x4 feet wide, was an elaborate operation. Neil described to me how the burglars moved through it.
Laying on back, you had a little old thing, trailer laying like on railroad track. And he lay down on that. That's where they had these wooden things that across the ceiling of it, you see. So you lay on your back and pull this way, where you get in. So I went under, went from the back through one end of that tunnel to the other, you see.
Can you repeat that real quickly, just in the microphone? So it was wooden slates.
Yeah.
On the ceiling.
On the ceiling of the tunnel. The tunnel was a 3x3 or 4x4, something about the size of that there, right there. And the way that they got back and forth is they had these little wagons, if you will, with wheels on it, and they lay on those wagons and reach up into the ceiling of that tunnel and had wooden rafters that you could reach up and touch. And that's what they'd reach up and pull like this, is where they'd go back and forth.
So they'd basically be on their backs.
On their back.
On the wagon, and then they would pull themselves on those wooden rafters.
Right.
That's so interesting. And then you actually saw the rooms of dirt. Can you describe what that was like?
Oh, yeah. The dirt, red clay, was up to on a room that had a 10-foot ceiling. Dirt was up to 8 feet, you see, in the bed, and it was just full. That's where the morning, you could see where the red clay had been, you see. And it had been up to 8 feet high in that ground floor.
As the day unfolded, the full extent of the crime became more unbelievable.
From that, looking towards the bank building, you could tell that the shrubbery on the exterior of the building was dead. Because they had tunneled under there and dug all of that, and all that, you could just tell exactly where they went in, because the shrubbery in the front of the building was all green, except one place was just brown. That was because they had dug all that dirt from out from under it.
So they had essentially killed the root systems of that plant, trying to get under the road.
Wow. Yeah.
That's crazy. And then
got on the road and get under the building. You see, had to go under the building to come up under it, up under the vault. They had to go under the building for 12 to 15 feet.
The burglars had secretly tunneled under Marietta's busiest street. Over the course of 2 months, hauling away hundreds of pounds of dirt without drawing suspicion. But for Neil Barfield, the priority was getting the bank back to normal.
You've arrived to the bank, you've talked to Arthur. What do you as a president need to do next?
Well, just get back to business and get back to business as soon as possible. No one will let all the enforcement, the police and the enforcement take care of the rest of the week. We're out of it now. We got to get back to work doing our banking business, you see.
Repairs on the safety deposit box room took months, but the bigger mystery remained. Who pulled off this heist? Despite the scale of the operation, there were no arrests and no suspects.
Now, do you ever remember hearing anything about the perpetrators, the suspects involved?
Not at all. Not the first word. Never heard a word about any of them.
Did you think that was curious that nobody in town really ever knew who did this crime?
Sure did. Still wonder about that, but it just happened. And I wasn't on the scene, I wasn't there. Of course, wouldn't matter if I was or not. I was not in the building when it actually happened. When they actually blew up and came inside the building, you see. Inside that ball. So, we just got back to business as soon as we could and tried to keep everything normal. I never even knew. I mean, they just didn't catch the guys and had no idea, no clue as to who they were, as far as I know.
One of the parts I love about this story is how long it's been in the making. The 50th anniversary of the Cobb Exchange Bank burglary was in 2024. The recollection by some of these folks we've spoken to is phenomenal. Neil Barfield was 81 at the time of our interview in 2021. Even after 50 years, most Mariettans still don't know who broke into the Cobb Exchange that fateful day. But according to police records, law enforcement knew the perpetrators within a matter of days. On the day of the burglary, Marietta police detectives, with the help of FBI agent Al Brown, were able to trace certain power tools found at the scene to several businesses in the area. A clerk at a Sears on Roswell Street recalled selling the hydraulic jacks to a man just a week prior. He was accompanied by a woman and gave the name Ray during the transaction. Remember, we learned from episode 2 that Leslie Ray of Ackworth was the registered owner of the blue 1967 Chevrolet Impala that was spotted in the emergency aid parking lot and commonly driven by our three suspects. Law enforcement contacted a manager at the DuPont Company office in Tucker, Georgia, to trace the dynamite used in the burglary. An officer contacted Stevens Ornamental Iron Works on Canton Highway after the business had reported the theft of oxygen and acetylene tanks, though these appeared to be different from the ones located at the bank. The boxes used to contain the dirt in the basement suite were traced back to Eon Box Company in Atlanta. Walter Drew, president of the company, relayed to the police that a Harold A. Murphy had written them a check for the purchase of 500 boxes in March of that year. Remember Mr. Murphy, the proclaimed owner of the fictitious Murphy Salon and suspect number one? He was spotted by Mr. Drew and his secretary picking up the boxes with a man similar to the description of our more muscular suspect, man number two. Both Mr. Drew and his secretary recalled the men arriving in a blue Chevrolet truck with tools and dirt in the bed. They claimed man number two was dirty and mentioned he had been working underneath the house on the plumbing. Police were able to find an address listed for Mr. Murphy under his bank account at Cobb Exchange, leading them to Decatur, Georgia. The address appeared to be a vacant lot, but it was next door to a man named Scott, who had served time. Neighbors in the area said Scott owned a blue Chevrolet pickup truck. That afternoon, Marietta police and FBI agents had tracked the suspect Leslie Ray to a house in Ackworth, a white one-story home 100 yards east of Bells Ferry Road in neighboring Cherokee County. No one appeared to be home at the time, though interviews with neighbors revealed three people had been living there for about a month. A man, a woman, and a boy of about 14. The blue Chevy had also frequently been spotted in the driveway. Agents discovered the home had been rented out by Leslie Ray for at least a month after contacting the landlord. When the homeowner opened the house for police, they discovered Ray and his counterparts had clearly vacated the building. By Wednesday, the Marietta police and FBI had conducted a search of the home for latent prints. One item of interest was a piece of green water hose lying in the yard that appeared to be the same type of hose used in the tunnel as an airway. The hose had been cut up with a sharp instrument. On Friday, eyewitnesses would help police create composite sketches of Murphy, Ray, Ray's wife, man number two, and man number three. FBI agents began showing them pictures of the potential suspects. By Sunday, April 28, 1974, just a week after the first alarm would go off at Cobb Exchange Bank, an eyewitness would look over a set of photographs with the FBI to identify Leslie Ray. But the man he pointed to was not Leslie Ray. His name was Morris Lynn Johnson. So, to summarize, after the bank break-in, cops and the FBI started piecing things together using tools and gear left at the scene. They tracked down receipts, talked to store clerks, and followed leads to a rental house about 15 miles away that had already been cleared out. Witnesses helped create sketches, and when one finally ID'd Leslie Ray, it turned out the guy was actually someone else entirely. Coming up on the next episode of Robbery, Inc., we'll dive into the life and legend of career criminal Morris Lynn Johnson, his multiple bank robberies, prison escapes, and being one of the FBI's most wanted.
The FBI said Johnson made the 10 most wanted list because he is believed armed with automatic weapons and should be considered extremely dangerous.
Police Chief Buck Kraft says the suspect, now in custody, served time in the Atlanta Penitentiary for bank robbery.
Every newspaper, radio, and TV station except you will get the news when identities are released.
You're probably thinking the same thing that I'm thinking. Who the hell is this guy? Robbery, Inc. is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Marietta Daily Journal. Robbery, Inc. is written and hosted by Madison Elizabeth Hogan. I'm on Instagram at Madison Elizabeth Hogan. This podcast was produced and edited by GPB's podcast team of Jeremy Powell, Jake Cook, and Mark Davenport. Special thanks to Olivia Watkin, Jaden Henson, and Rachel Kellogg.